in-depth look at the engaging debate on US, China, and global issues. This is The Heat.
Hello, I'm Arnand Naidu, and this is a special edition of The Heat. The IMF says the global economy remains resilient and raised its global growth forecast to 3.2% this year. The report comes as finance leaders are gathering in Washington, D.C. for the IMF World Bank spring meetings. Later, we'll hear from the president of the Center for Global Development on some of the challenges developing countries are facing. But first, my interview with Amir Hamza Azizan, the second finance minister of Malaysia. We discussed a range of issues, including Malaysia's transition to a digital and tech economy and trade relations with China. Minister, thanks so much for joining us. You came to government in Malaysia via the corporate world. You served in the corporate world for some time. You were the head of Malaysia's largest pension fund. And you've made the point that you are a technocrat, not a politician. What is the significance of that distinction?
I think it's important to look at where Malaysia is in the state of its reform, right? And one of the key elements of the reform requires Malaysia to undertake a large transformation of systems that we actually have. So one of the key things that the Prime Minister wanted to do was effectively depoliticize the Ministry of Finance. So then he looked for people who could actually help him in the journey of making sure we put in the right policies, we put in the right systems that we need to do so that we can take Malaysia to a new era.
Now, you're a developing country full of potential. You've made the transition to a digital, a tech economy to a large extent. You've adopted cutting-edge technologies in many respects to drive that kind of growth. Talk to us about the digital economy and how that became one of the fastest-growing sectors in Malaysia.
I think if you look at Malaysia's history, we started off as an agri economy, right? And over the years, we've understood that it's important that the economy is much more diversified than a single sector base and not just a commodity-based economy. And over the years, what we've done is created segments of the market that can compete on a global scale. Our electronics and electrical segments is actually one of the biggest one. And as technology progresses in the world today, it's a natural extension that we start to move into newer areas such as digital and technology and so on. So one of the key things that Malaysia wants to do is actually take leading positions within an ASEAN area in this space. It requires the government to be very clear in terms of its policies, its focus areas, and also to invest back into infrastructure. So if you look at, for example, the adoption of 5G, Malaysia is one of the fastest places that 5G has been adopted. Today, despite the rollout of less than 2 years, we already have 80% coverage of urban population covered under 5G. Because this opens up an avenue for us to embrace newer capability and the use of 5G as underpinning the Internet of Things and so on are an important element. Therefore, creating a good ecosystem for newer businesses to flourish in Malaysia.
Now, of course, all this comes with challenges. The East Asia Forum recently published a report which said that inflation remains a concern in Malaysia right now. Some of that is driven by the fact that we're still seeing the effects of the Ukraine war in a country like Malaysia. Higher fuel prices, higher food prices, fertilizer prices are high as well. How do you meet those challenges?
I think if you look at Malaysia, Malaysia has been fairly lucky over the years because I think the diversified economy allows it to get revenue sources along the way that helps manage fiscal capacity. But one of the things that we have done is also to make sure that we protect the population through some support mechanisms that has come in. So that's allowed us to contain the effect of inflation into the system. Secondly, I think our self-sufficiency levels in a lot of things are pretty good. So dependency for importation is not very high. As such, the inflationary effect to the market is not big. So if you look at our latest data on inflation, we're down to about 1.8%. Inflation. So I don't think inflation is that problematic. However, when we looked at the interventions during the COVID era, we had to do a lot of support to the economy. And in some of the support, we've been giving subsidies in areas that we now need to look at refining them again. So probably in this year, we will have some amount of knock-on effect as we allow prices to come up to market prices. But we believe it will be within a contained range. At the moment, the current estimate of inflation for this year should be anything between 2.5 to 3.5%, which is acceptable for this stage.
Okay, let's turn to your trade and economic relationship with China. China remains your largest trading partner. That's for the 15th consecutive year since 2009, making up about 17% of Malaysia's total external trade in 2023. How would you characterize the relationship?
No, I think we have a very good relationship with China. Actually, Malaysia has a very good relationship with a lot of people. Because the reality is we are an open trading nation. So China accounts for about 17% of our total exports. Yeah? And it's built on a two-way mechanism where we import and China also exports into Malaysia. And we export also into China. So there's quite a good balance on both sides. The key is actually making sure that whatever we do, it fits into the business model that Malaysia is looking at, the sectors that we want growth. And I'm happy to see that China's investing also in Malaysia into newer technology area. So we've got new people like ByteDance, for example, coming in and helping us on building a vibrant data center sort of segments. We have CSCIC coming in to help us with our East Coast rail structure, so helping us with infrastructure and so on. So there are a lot of things that's coming in. Correspondingly, Malaysia also exports quite a lot of things into China. A lot of palm oil goes into China, some petroleum products go into China, and a lot of electronics also goes back into China. So it's a very strong codependent relationship between the two.
That's right. Of course, China's made tremendous progress in various technological sectors. You know, if you look at things like artificial intelligence, green energy technology, semiconductor technology. I mean, you've pointed out some of the areas where you are cooperating right now, but what is the potential for greater cooperation in the years ahead?
Again, I think when you look at Malaysia, we play an important leg within the world as an open trading economy. And one of the key sectors of our evolution is actually to upsize and uplift the quality of industries in Malaysia. So what we're looking for is welcoming all countries to come into Malaysia, invest into the sectors that we actually like, as underpinned by our national industrial master plan. Things like, if you look at the semiconductor sectors, are very, very key sectors. Because Malaysia is probably one of the largest semiconductor countries in the world today. So the ecosystem is already quite vibrant. So bringing in new things into Malaysia actually helps lift it up. But also, people who come into Malaysia already has a resident base that's strong. So supply chains are a lot easier. So in this light, I think there is a tremendous amount of potential where newer things can come in. So if we look at our focus areas under NIMP, we like things like electronics and semiconductors as growth areas. We like things like aerospace as a potential space to grow in. But we also have traditional areas that we also need support in. Fundamentally, as Malaysia transitions under its national energy transition roadmap, that we become a lot more greener and so on. And re-looking at our grid, re-looking at our generation capacity as we inject in more solar, may be great things to actually look at strengthening relationships.
So a time of change in Malaysia in many respects. What are the policies that you are putting in place to attract foreign investment?
I think Malaysia has been in this game for a very, very long time. Yeah, and one of the key things that we use to focus on is actually laying out quite clear master plans that we actually want people to focus on. As I said, last year we rolled out our new National Industrial Master Plan with key focus sectors that we want to grow in. And in those particular sectors, then the government looks at how do we facilitate ease of doing business within Malaysia. In this instance, there are a couple of key things that we'll have to do. Incentives are quite norm to be looking at how do you support new entrants into the market. But more importantly is actually looking at the whole ecosystem itself in terms of how do you make it easier for businesses to come. The ease of doing business, the approval process, the facilitation in terms of ease of movements of goods, in terms of custom clearance and stuff, are very, very important elements to be looked at. So Malaysia is doing a lot of reform in terms of simplifying the way and things are done in the country. The second thing is also understanding that as we move up the value chain and as we uplift the skill requirements in the country, then we will have to also invest in actually lifting up quality of resources inside it. We've got a very good base of labour already, but as newer industries come in, newer technology come in, we also must supplement that with further partnerships between industry and government to see how we continue to lift up capability within the sector. So Malaysia is actually putting in a clear roadmap in terms of how to inject in better TVET mechanisms, better industry government partnership to lift up skill levels in the country.
Let's talk about financial cooperation. You are, of course, aware that there's a move afoot right now in many countries around the world, particularly the BRICS countries, looking for an alternative to the United States dollar as a reserve currency. What is your view on that?
I think it's a normal evolution that we will have to look at. As the world gets closer together and multiple economies start to trade a lot more with each other, making sure that we have alternate mechanisms that trade can be settled in is actually a very, very important facet. This is not trying to displace one currency over the other, but making sure that a much more balanced mechanism can actually be done. So there's a lot of work that's been done in terms of local currency settlements between trade arrangements between countries now. And Malaysia will continue to facilitate by opening up to facilitate more and more of these things to be done. This also allows us to manage variations that come in when you are over-dependent in a particular currency and so on. Then you are open to currency appreciation, currency depreciation and stuff like that. But a much more diversified reduces the risk and allows countries to better manage their position.
You know, you were talking a moment ago about changes in how the Malaysian government functions and how it's seen depoliticizing the finance ministry, for instance. You've said that Malaysians need to appreciate the importance of a better governance structure for the country. Elaborate on that for us.
No, I think the reality is Malaysia is an open trading nation. Yeah, and one of the ways that we actually grow the economy is actually by welcoming a lot of foreign investments into the country. And when you are an investor into the country, you want predictability, you want clarity of how things are done, you want efficiency of how things are done. You also want to make sure that the system is managed so that there are no material variations over time, because you're in it for a very, very long play, right? So for Malaysia, I think one of the key challenges we've had in the past is we had circumstances where maybe the efficiency level of that has not been as good as what we wanted it to be. And then people start to worry about whether the cost of doing business was going to be increased more than it should be along the way. So this administration's focus is actually to provide clarity. This administration focus is actually about looking at ways and means that we can do more to ease the capacity to do business in Malaysia and making sure that proper, transparent government processes are in place. So when people want to do things in Malaysia, they understand how it can be done. And when they get treated and by doing things in Malaysia, they have no risk or worry that there are undue pressures that are being applied. Yeah? So that they don't stand a fair chance of actually doing and getting what they need to be getting. So I think that's important. It allows the economy to function much smoother, but more importantly, it assures comfort within the country. It assures that people can do and trust and are prepared to take risks for a longer term period, because investments will take time to crystallize. Yeah? So you need to provide the framework of certainty within the country.
Developing countries facing high debt burden often struggle to invest in education and healthcare at the detriment of future generations. It's one of the challenges I discussed with Masoud Ahmed, the president of the Center for Global Development. Masoud, thanks so much for joining us. You are very closely involved in the challenges that developing countries face. And one of those challenges is the enormous debt burden that a number of countries are carrying right now. In fact, you wrote recently that 23 countries in Africa have unsustainable debt levels, but One of the things that you also point out, that most of these countries, in fact, the majority of these countries, do not default on their loans. They pay their loans back, with the exception of probably three or four countries. And even in those instances, those debts are restructured. And you say that in many instances, they pay their loans back at the expense of things in their countries, like expenditure on education, on healthcare, on critical infrastructure. I mean, how does one change that scenario? How do these countries escape from that cycle of repayment debt and repayment again?
Well, I think, Anand, in the very near term, what we have to do is to make sure that the liquidity, the support that these countries are getting, that the fresh money that they're getting, enables them to pay back their loans, but also, do we have enough left over to invest in health and education? Because as I said, to me, the real problem is that they're not defaulting on their creditors, but they are defaulting to their next generation of children because they're not investing in the health and education. Beyond that, longer term, we've got to find a way for these countries to be able to borrow at rates that are more reasonable. A couple of countries have recently gone to the market and got euro bonds, and one level, that's good news. That means the markets are open to them. But they're borrowing at rates that are near double-digit rates, and that's going to be very hard for any country to pay back.
You know, you say they are defaulting on the next generation. So what are the long-term effects of what we are seeing right now when they don't have enough money to pay for things like education or healthcare?
Long-term effects, particularly in the poorest countries, is that you're going to see a generation of kids growing up who are not going to have the skills that they need to be able to compete in the marketplace for tomorrow, and they're not going to have the physical capabilities, the mental capabilities that come from malnutrition, and you end up with stunting being a large issue across poor countries. And so we're all going to have to face the consequences of that. And we might think that that's a problem for tomorrow, but tomorrow comes around much more quickly than people anticipate.
Right, you also mentioned the problem of getting affordable loans. You point out that international financial institutions like the World Bank and OECD countries that traditionally offered cheap funding are now backing away from that, opening the way for more expensive commercial banks to get involved. Why is that happening? You know, why is an organization like the World Bank become so risk averse?
Well, I think there are three reasons for this. One is that if you look at the money that used to come in the form of official development assistance, aid flows, as we refer to them, bilateral aid flows, those have got diverted towards some of the new challenges. So they're going to finance reconstruction and humanitarian assistance in Ukraine and the other conflict areas. They're dealing with a growing number of refugees, and it's interesting that for a number of the richest countries, the largest amount of aid money that they're spending is within their own borders on housing refugees and asylum seekers, and they're going in to deal with new global challenges like pandemics and climate. Net result, aid flows to the poorest countries have actually gone down, even as the total aid numbers have gone up. Then you look at the multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the others. Well, they're doing their bit. They've increased and they're actually lending at record levels. But it's just not enough to keep up with the needs, but also with the fact that private capital flows have actually been coming out of developing countries. So if you look at last year, 2023, private capital flows didn't go into developing countries. $200 billion came out of developing countries. So net-net, developing countries are actually financing the rest of the world rather than the other way around.
Masood, poverty reduction, that's a key part of the Center for Global Development's mission. And in that respect, you know, China's had enormous success with lifting people out of poverty. More than 800 million people have been lifted out of poverty, as well as extreme poverty. But given the tough economic times we face right now with higher fuel costs, higher food prices, we're still seeing the impact of the COVID pandemic. I mean, how big is that challenge?
First thing I think we have to recognize is that last 30 years, we've really seen an enormous improvement in living standards. 1.5 billion people have been lifted out of poverty, about half in China, but not only in China. Now it's much tougher, and it's much tougher because the challenges that they face are in places where it's harder to lift people out of poverty. They're in conflict countries, they're in fragile states, they're in communities that are marginalized and in countries that are doing a little bit better. And if you look at the numbers today, for the poorest countries, only about half of them have actually got back to the level of incomes that they had just before the pandemic. The pandemic really was a very big shock for the poorest countries, and half of them are still struggling to recover from that.
You know, there was a recent social media post that you wrote, and you said in that post, you said, and I'm quoting you here, "We can thank economic growth for advancing human welfare across the world, but our current growth model has damaged our environment and left behind unacceptable poverty and inequality." I mean, you were talking about some of that a moment ago, but elaborate a bit more on that for us.
Well, look, the poverty part, I think it's clear that it's going to be harder because we're going to have to find customized solutions to deal with the pockets of poverty, which, as I said, are mostly in fragile states, and it will increasingly be in conflict zones and fragile states and in marginalized communities. Now, the second big problem is that the model of growth that we used to follow, which was essentially an export-led industrial model, we weren't that conscious about the consequences of this for the environment. That model no longer works. What we need to do is to move developing countries to the escalator of green growth. But that's easier said than done. Less than 10% of the global investment in green energy is taking place in developing countries, partly because they don't have a very good pipeline of projects, partly because it's harder to mobilize financing for it. And for that reason, you find that they run the risk of being left behind in terms of dealing with the kind of growth model that the rest of the world will be migrating to. It'll be migrating in fits and starts. It won't be a smooth and linear transformation, but we will eventually get to a more climate-friendly, sustainable growth path, and we need to make sure that the developing countries aren't bystanders in that.
Right, and looking at the broader growth model that we have been following, is there too much of an emphasis on GDP, on GDP growth? I mean, there are many economists, many analysts who say that it would be far more advantageous for everybody to focus more on human development. I mean, do you see any merit in that?
I think GDP growth is a very useful shorthand way of measuring one dimension of progress. There is very little evidence that you can achieve sustained improvements in human development without improvements in income, i.e. GDP. So you need growth, you need a different kind of growth, but without growth, you can't really deliver sustained improvements in the human condition. But the challenge for us is to try and make that growth more inclusive, to make that growth greener, to make that growth one where there's less inequality.
Okay, let's talk about the fight against climate change and how that fits into future growth, economic growth in developing countries. I mean, there are climate activists right now who want the World Bank to stop financing carbon-emitting energy projects like natural gas and instead transition to green energy projects. Is that already happening? Is it still a challenge?
It is happening. It's not happening fast enough. So the World Bank, other regional development banks are all trying to increase the financing that they do for clean energy in developing countries. And the solution to me is to help developing countries with the clean energy projects and with an energy trajectory that is going to deliver them more energy. Remember, half the people in Africa today do not have access to electricity. So the question is, how can you provide access to electricity to this group of people in a way that is consistent with the planet moving to net zero? At the end, 30 years from now, a lot of developing countries will need to be consuming more energy, and some of them will need to have higher emissions before they transition to lower emissions to net zero. And natural gas may be part of that solution. I think personally that rather than focusing on what the World Bank shouldn't finance, I want to focus on how they can finance the things that they should finance faster and at a larger scale.
Well, that's it for this special edition of The Heat. I'm Anand Naidu in Washington, D.C.